This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
I'd just be happy if they all go home and they can license their programs back to Canadian broadcasters, and we can reinstitute the model that worked in this country for so many years. But, you know, that's not going to happen. So they must contribute to the system. They must contribute to local news.
That was Randy Kitt, Unifor Media Director, during the recent CRTC hearing on Canadian content and the implementation of Bill C-11, the Online Streaming Act. Kitt was pining for what he saw as the good old days before the internet, when, it should be noted, the broadcasters paid into the CanCon system in return for a favorable regulatory framework and limited competition, while individual Canadians took what they were given, with little choice or control over broadcast options. The two-week CRTC hearing featured most of the usual suspects, though notably not the large streaming services, as the Commission grappled with modernizing the definition of Canadian content, instituting IP requirements, and introducing new discoverability rules into Canada's broadcasting regulatory framework. Mark Musselman is a former entertainment lawyer, longtime Canadian movie producer, current PhD student focused on cultural and legal policy, and the author of the white paper Black Coffee Substack. Having appeared many times before the CRTC, he now joins me on the podcast to discuss the recent CanCon hearing, breaking down the major issues of debate and identifying what was missing from the discussion. Mark, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be here.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure having you. You know, the CRTC hearings into CanCon and the Online Streaming Act recently wrapped up with virtually all of the usual suspects appearing, though in a late decision, most of the major internet streamers decided to take a pass. I'd like to talk with you a bit about some of the key areas of debate and takeaways that we saw from that activity at the CRTC. But first, you know, you've been involved both on the legal side and on the film and TV side in Canada for decades. Can you introduce yourself and a bit of the background that you've had in both in film and TV in Canada, as well as some of your legal experience?
Sure. Well, I am a lawyer by trade and by trading. And I'm a lawyer who has spent his entire career working in and around Canada's cultural industries, particularly in film and television. I initially began my career as an entertainment and communications lawyer at the Goodmans Law Firm in Toronto and Vancouver, and then spent nearly two decades at Serendipity Point Films, which is a Toronto-based production company, where I oversaw all of the commercial aspects of the business of production and distribution, from financing and international co-production to licensing, tax credit, rights management, and most relevant for this conversation, a lot of Canadian content certification. So I'm now back in academia. I'm doing a PhD and researching the role of cultural regulation in shaping national identity. So these CRTC hearings have been of both professional and academic interest to me.
Okay. Well, you're a perfect person for this. And I know that you've got a new Substack that you've launched that has touched on some of that stuff. We'll put a link to it in the show notes, but it's definitely a highly recommend. You know, why don't we start by situating the hearing itself, and then we can come to what took place over the couple of weeks of the hearing. Listeners are going to be familiar with Bill C-11, the Online Streaming Act. For a better part of a couple of years, it was much discussed on this podcast, largely in the context of user content regulation. But these hearings aren't really focused on that issue, with the exception of a few witnesses that brought it back and I guess saw further assurances that the CRTC was not going to go there. So what really was this hearing about? How does it fit within the broader CRTC implementation of this legislation of the Online Streaming Act?
Yeah, good idea. Let's start with giving some context to these hearings. This hearing was part of the CRTC's process to implement the Online Streaming Act. And your audience will know that the purpose of that act is to modernize the Broadcasting Act, and among other things, give the Commission new powers to regulate online undertakings, which include global streaming services like Netflix and Disney Plus, Paramount Plus, Amazon Prime Video, etc. The CRTC divided its hearings around implementation into three separate phases. Phase one dealt with some administrative matters around what streamers were actually in scope and set some interim financial obligations. The commission's decision last November ordered that online streaming services, which earn more than $20 million in Canadian revenues, are immediately required to start contributing 5% of those revenues towards the Canadian broadcasting system. Phase two, which is the subject of the hearing of the last couple of weeks, asked what counts as Canadian programming under the modernized framework. This phase is critical because defining what a Canadian program is affects not only what kinds of programs get made with financial support from the broadcasting system, but also who gets to make them, who has the right or sometimes the obligation to distribute them, and who is ultimately eligible for public funding. And the last phase, phase three, which is scheduled to begin later this year, is set to determine how much online broadcasters must ultimately contribute and how those contributions are to be allocated. So this hearing was less, you were right, less about regulating user content, which got much of the C11 debate attention, and more around revisiting legacy definitions due to the regulatory system's recent inclusion of internet streaming companies.
Okay. Yeah. No. So there were some previous episodes that talked about that phase one that you mentioned. Those outcomes are currently the subject of some litigation, but the CRTC marches on. So CanCon is a big part of this hearing, really the core part of this hearing. There's both an audio and an audio visual component to it, film and TV and music. We're gonna park music for the most part here and focus on film and TV. Some people are familiar with this notion of certified Canadian content or CanCon, but not everybody is. And you mentioned that this is something that you did as part of your role for many years. Can you talk a little bit about what the system looks like right now, given that part of what the CRTC has been thinking about are potential changes to that system?
Right. Right now, a producer can seek certification from the CRTC by meeting the requirements of what is a 10-point certification test. It's based on cast and crew nationality. I should note that there are alternatives to the CRTC's process for certification. Those include certification as a co-venture or as a treaty co-production, but let's leave those aside for the sake of simplicity and just focus on the CRTC mechanism. So under the CRTC's process, a production must have a Canadian producer with full financial and creative control over production and needs to score at least 6 out of 10 points on a scale, again, which is based on the nationality of key creative personnel. For example, you have a Canadian director, you get 2 points. You have a Canadian in the lead role, you get a point. You have a Canadian music composer, you get another point. And those points add up to 10. And so currently, to qualify under this particular regime, the production needs to meet 6 out of 10 points and have a Canadian producer.
That's the current system. Before the hearing, the CRTC put some proposed changes on the table. What have they been thinking about in light of the passage of Bill C-11, the Online Streaming Act, and its reforms to the Broadcasting Act?
Yeah, I have to say that the commission really did its work in preparation for this hearing. They laid out a broad discussion framework that's aimed at modernizing the definition of Canadian program. Among other things, the commission did focus on definitions. It proposed changes to the 10-point certification test that I just discussed, suggesting that perhaps it could be expanded to a 15-point model to reflect a wider range of creative and production roles. The CRTC also flagged the need to rethink how programs of national interest, which are Typically, Canadian programming that is more difficult to make profitably are defined and supported, and how Canadian programming expenditure requirements could be structured in an environment where both traditional broadcasters and streamers are contributing. So the CRTC wanted feedback on whether additional roles should be Canadian, perhaps weighted slightly differently. It also raised questions about ownership of intellectual property. And in effect, the notice asked whether the current model still serves the public interest or whether a more flexible, a more layered approach could better align with the goals of the Broadcasting Act, including enhancing Canada's social, economic, and cultural fabric, which is one of the objectives of the Act.
So we'll come certainly to IP ownership, which was certainly one of the issues that came up repeatedly as part of the discussion with various witnesses. And obviously many witnesses come with their own set of asks. We're not going to go, we don't have time to go through every witness. I think it's worthwhile going through every witness.
Thankfully.
Yeah, indeed. But I'd love to get sort of, before we get into some of the specifics, some high level takes. At a high level, it struck me that Friends of Canadian Broadcasting, for example, said in part the following. They said, "This proceeding is about how to best create Canadian programming for Canadian audiences, how to keep the Canadian in the Canadian broadcasting system." Would you agree? Do you think that's how it played out?
Well, that was certainly the rhetorical frame that many stakeholders chose to use. But in practice, much of the hearing was about access, access to certification, access to funding, access to protected markets. Very few parties actually used their time to reflect critically on whether the CanCon regime was achieving its goals. Instead, we heard a chorus of rather familiar appeals, protect our niche, preserve our eligibility, provide us with more flexibility, give us access to segregated funding to support our particular constituency, these kinds of things. So if it was about keeping the Canadian in the system, it was Canadian more in the nature of systemic entitlement, really, than by cultural purpose.
Okay. No, and the reference to Canadian audiences and the audience, at least my take as I went through it, was the audiences were rarely there. There were a few people that referenced audiences, but that wasn't a big focal point, notwithstanding some of the rhetoric. What was also a big focal point, though, in addition to some of the niches that you're talking about, were the streamers, who, as I mentioned off the top, did not appear. The MPA, Motion Picture Association, appeared nominally to represent some of those perspectives, but at the last minute, some of those larger streamers did not. And certainly, it seemed to me, I'm interested in your take, that there seemed to be a fair amount of either anger or fear, maybe a bit of both amongst many with regard to the streamers, who, it should be noted, and certainly the chair of the CRTC repeatedly noted, had been arguing for flexibility. I think she repeatedly noted that Netflix raised the issue of flexibility, I think 50 times in their written submission, even though it didn't appear. In fact, Unifor, when they appeared, stated, and I'll quote, "I would be just as happy if they would all go home and they can license their programs back to Canadian broadcasters and we can reinstitute the model that worked in this country for so many years." I mean, that sure feels like a kind of back to the future. Things were way better in the
Great
80s
idea.
when Canadian audiences had no control, no choice, and you had a small number of players that got to decide what people could access and when they could access this. Is there an element here, at least for some, of almost desperately wanting to put the toothpaste back in the tube and saying that the current far more complex world, where there's certainly more competition and more choice for users, just isn't good for certain players, and those players were some of them were the ones that were appearing before the CRTC.
Absolutely. There was a very strong nostalgic current running through many of the submissions, and Unifor's position captures that sentiment perfectly. For decades, the Canadian broadcasting system operated under a tightly controlled, vertically integrated model. Foreign content providers were forced to go through Canadian broadcasters, who in turn then were required to reinvest in Canadian news and entertainment. That model, you know, it created stability. And for some, it created employment. And for others, it created cultural relevance. But the streaming components, those streaming players, have forever changed the game. Platforms like Netflix and YouTube operate entirely outside that traditional distribution model. They go direct to consumers on demand and at scale. And that's terrifying for legacy stakeholders, not just because it disrupts their business model, but I think also because it exposes how little cultural leverage we have in a global media environment. So yes, there is an element of trying to rewind the clock, of imagining we can somehow force these platforms to operate like conventional broadcasters, but the toothpaste is out. The question now is whether we design regulation that acknowledges that reality, or whether we double down on trying to protect a system that's already been fundamentally altered. And the anger is perhaps understandable, and the fear is definitely real, but the solution probably isn't going to be found through nostalgia.
No, I think you're right about that. There is no turning back the clock, at least with respect to this area. Now, there were four major issues that I wanted to touch on. There were more as part of the discussions, but these four seem to come up repeatedly amongst the CRTC commissioners and the witnesses. First off, as we mentioned before, was how the definition for Canadian content for CanCon should be adjusted, if at all. What were some of the proposals that we heard? So you mentioned off the top, the CRTC did some heavy lifting in advance. You know, what kind of responses did it get from the witnesses? And more broadly, for those that don't follow this, you know, how does the Canadian system today, or potentially in the future, based on the CRTC's proposals, how does it compare to how some other countries do this?
Yeah, well, we heard a lot of proposals, but the headline, I think, the takeaway is that the current 10-point system is on the table for reform. As we've discussed, CanCon is currently defined primarily by who holds creative roles, the director, writer, performers, etc. You get points for having Canadians in those positions, and you have six of them and a Canadian producer, you qualify. The commission has floated this idea of moving to a 15-point system to bring in roles like showrunners and casting directors, or even visual effects leads. But there was also talk of reweighting the system, giving more value to certain roles, or allowing flexibility if, for example, ownership isn't Canadian, but creative control is high. Compared to other countries, our system is relatively rigid. The UK, for instance, uses a cultural test that gives partial credit for things like subject matter, UK filming location. Yes, UK nationality of the cast and crew, but it doesn't require a specific number of points in set roles. France, by contrast, takes a much more forceful approach. It has direct quotas on investment and requirements for European content. So is this a major change? I think it depends on what the commission does next. If they truly expand and rebalance the system to reflect ownership, long-term value, and creative leadership, that's a significant shift. But if they just bolt on a few new roles to the existing point system without really rethinking what success looks like, then yes, I think we're tinkering around the edges. But the structure stays intact, and even with a few of the parts getting swapped in or swapped out.
Yeah. You know, you've mentioned this notion of success already a couple of times. So what do you think success looks like? And was there anybody really focusing on success, or was it more just about continuing to prime the pump in terms of providing support to the sector to keep making stuff without as much regard for sort of success, commercial, artistic, or otherwise?
Well, I think success is in the eye of the beholder. Success for the Canadian Media Producers Association is ongoing access to funding for their members. Success for ACTRA, the performers union, is holding strong to the requirements of Canadians in lead roles, and perhaps even seeking an artist fund for the support of development of an English Canadian star system. There was a lot of talk about how success was difficult to achieve unless the commission was sensitive and responsive to the demands of each particular respondent. So, as I said a little earlier, there wasn't a lot of soul searching about what success would mean in terms of result. There was more a much more partisan, I'd say, approach to explain to the commission that success re relies entirely on responsiveness to their own needs.
Yeah, interesting. You mentioned IP ownership as being one of the factors that gets weighed in the potential recalculation with this system. Can you talk a bit about this issue around IP ownership? That was one where it seemed like everybody had an opinion. What do the rules say right now, and what are some of the options that might be embraced? And I guess even further, why are we discussing this now? What impact, I suppose, do these large streamers have that has in some ways forced a bit of a reconsideration around IP ownership?
Well, the commission proposed that reconsideration of ownership as a factor in determining whether a program qualifies as Canadian. Specifically, it asked stakeholders to respond to the question. This was in the material that they had prepared in advance of the hearing. They had asked for responses as to whether Canadian copyright ownership should be one, mandatory for certification. To one of several qualifying criteria within sort of a broader flexible model, or three, not considered at all in determining CanCon status. Now, this is a tricky one. IP ownership is about who owns copyright. Now, the commission and many of the interveners seem to me to understand intellectual property or copyright ownership as a proxy for the right to the downstream revenues, which are generated by licensing and exploitation of a program. In reality, they're different concepts entirely, which I'd caution the commission to consider rather carefully. But regardless, for traditional Canadian producers, and I'm excluding here those who make their livings as hired guns for the production of American film and TV in Canada, retaining IP, or rather the economic benefit, is critical because it allows producers to build catalogs, to reinvest, and develop long-term sustainability. And that sustainability often depends not just on direct licensing revenues, but more on ancillary rights like TV or film adaptations, spin-offs, remakes, merchandising, and even live theater adaptations. In fact, the Producers Association pointed to Letterkenny, Canadian production, to illustrate how owning the underlying IP allows Canadian producers to extend the life and value of their property far beyond the initial broadcast window. That's why the producers and others argue that IP ownership should be hardwired into the definition. But platforms like Netflix and Amazon, which customarily finance all of a project's budget, usually demand ownership of global rights in return. They're not usually interested in sharing copyright or economic rights with anyone. They push back in their written submissions, arguing that if the CRTC were to require exclusive Canadian IP ownership, there would be a major discouragement of investment. And so the commission outlined three potential certification models that treated ownership differently. There was a full ownership model where ownership of copyright and control over exploitation rights would be held by Canadians. This is the most stringent approach and would align most closely with traditional policy thinking and the position of organizations like the Producers Association. The second model was what they called a give and take or a symmetry model, where ownership could be traded off against other factors like higher Canadian creative control. This would allow flexibility in cases where Canadian ownership isn't achievable. Say there's a foreign financed production financed entirely outside of Canada, but provided Canadian creative roles were heavily weighted. And then the third model was one where ownership would not be mandatory or even shared, or foreign ownership could qualify if other conditions, such as economic benefit or Canadian cultural impact are met. And the commission didn't take a definitive position on which of those models it preferred, but invited stakeholders to comment on how ownership could interact with certification. The CRTC's this give and take model was, I think, an attempt at a compromise. If you don't have Canadian IP ownership, you need to demonstrate full Canadian creative control to qualify. But if a Canadian story is told using Canadian talent, but all of the rights and revenues flow to a US-based platform or a foreign financier, is that really content that is contributing to Canada's cultural or economic well-being? The current rules, you asked, they don't force us to answer that question. There is currently no requirement regarding copyright ownership under the CRTC certification mechanism. So this is what makes the IP discussion so important.
Okay. Super, super interesting. I mean, one can well see how, you know, the large streamers might say, hey, we're putting we have a lot of money coming into this. And so we're looking for the rights, and we operate on a global basis. And so these are the kind of rights that we need. But one, as you suggested, can see why some would push back on that, that if longer term, much of the value resides in having that intellectual property, how do you balance that out? And is there at least room to open the door to thinking about different models? It'd be interesting to see where the commission lands based on what they heard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were a couple of other issues that we could talk through quickly, I think. I did want to touch briefly on discoverability, which was one of those issues that came up a lot when we talked about during the Bill C-11 debate, especially around user-generated content. So there was a lot of talking about the role that large platforms would play to make Canadian content more discoverable, easier to find. We've seen those discussions resurface now with Quebec legislation that I'm going to address in a future podcast, or a bill that touches on discoverability. But I thought it was notable that, you know, when Bell appeared, they said, and of course, the owners of CTV, amongst many other well-known broadcasting channels, they said, discoverability of Canadian content is in our strategic interest. Essentially saying, we already have incentives to ensure that people can find the stuff that we've backed and that we fund. We want it to succeed. And in some ways, that's the same thing that the streamers have long tried to argue, that there are already incentives built into the market to ensure that subscribers can find the kind of content they're looking for, including Canadian content. Can you talk a bit about, to the extent to which the issue came up, you know, where are people landing it? There's still some saying, no, we need a commission to step in here and basically mandate that streamers or other services ensure that Canadian content is discoverable, so to speak, whatever exactly that happens to mean.
Well, I think there's a genuine difference in how broadcasters and streamers think about discoverability. Traditional broadcasters like Bell or Chorus, they're required to schedule and promote Canadian content as part of their license. So for them, CanCon is a quota. It's a condition. Streamers operate differently. They rely on algorithms, not schedules. They argue that their platforms will surface content based on user preferences. And if people want Canadian stories, the prominence of those stories will rise naturally as a result of an algorithmic function. The problem is that streaming algorithms are black boxes. We don't know how they work. We don't know how they rank content. And so discoverability becomes a policy concern, because without oversight, Canadian content might simply get buried.
Well, do you have any sense that the CRTC is going to step in with new kinds of requirements? You know, it's, as you say, in the broadcast world, at least the world before things started even there to shift to on demand, it mattered when program might appear. That's less the case now. But are we going to see something appear? And, you know, the concern, of course, around C-11 was getting into algorithmic regulation and tinkering by the regulator. Was that discussed at all, or is that something that we may see at a later date?
There was not a lot of attention given to those issues. You remember the arguments that were part of the C-11 debate, some arguments coming up that tinkering with the algorithm in favor of Canadian content might, at the end of the day, and place that content in a less advantageous position, a sort of a placement in the desert of Canadian content that people would not be looking for. I think that this is a highly technical area, and the commission is going to have a very difficult time getting the data that it needs in order to make an informed decision or come down with any kind of a policy pronouncement. And without first having some kind of an agreement amongst the parties as to what the true intent of discoverability means, what does it mean for Canadian broadcasters? What does it mean for online streamers? They're coming at this subject from entirely different places.
Okay, interesting. Speaking of technical and technical issues, the last issue that I thought we could touch on briefly was artificial intelligence, AI, which didn't necessarily was not a focal point certainly of during the debates over Bill C-11, but the vice chair, Thaberge, who was formerly with the Copyright Board, seemed to ask just about everybody about their views on AI. Do we have a sense at this stage how the CRTC might get itself engaged with respect to the role that AI plays in broadcasting and the creation of Canadian content? Or is it still early days and this is a bit more of a fact-finding kind of aspect of the CRTC's role?
Well, this was a bit of a head scratcher for me. The vice chair's concern was forward looking. You know, what happens when AI generated scripts or AI generated characters are used in a Canadian content project? Should a show generated in whole or in part by generative AI qualify as Canadian content? It's not a bad question to ask. You know, some participants warned about the risk of Canadian creators being displaced by technology. Others raised IP questions. You know, if an AI is trained on Canadian voices, does that constitute Canadian authorship? The commission didn't. They asked questions, but they didn't signal any kind of a clear path forward. They acknowledged that it's a fast-moving area. We may need some rules sooner or later because AI could undermine the very idea of national authorship that CanCon is meant to support. So I think that in time, if these concerns are realized, the commission will need to implement a regulatory response. But I would really hope that the Canadian government's response to the myriad concerns arising from AI is not left to the CRTC to determine.
No, hear, hear. And we do have a new AI minister who perhaps will jump on board and play a lead role in dealing with that. You know, why don't we close with this? You talked about sort of future plans and a forward-looking approach. What does the future hold for this? What, for those that don't closely follow CRTC type hearings and rulemaking, any sense of when a decision might be forthcoming, or what's the process that lies ahead, both for this, and then you mentioned that there is one more hearing to come. What's the timelines there?
Sure. Let me say three things on where we're going from here. First, my sense is that we're going to see some incremental change. The hearings revealed a lot about industry stakeholders and entrenched interests, industry groups advocating for themselves, really, rather than reflecting on outcomes. And parenthetically, that has been my biggest concern with the way these hearings were framed. But the CRTC will try to balance those interests. And I think without a clear policy direction from government, they're likely going to produce a cautious compromise. Second, the court challenge by the online streamers casts a real shadow over the entire process. And until that's resolved, I think there's a high degree of uncertainty. The commission has reserved the right to revisit the contribution percentage in phase three of the proceedings, and many stakeholder groups, including unions and traditional broadcasters, are calling for contributions from the streamers that are much higher than the interim 5% base level that has been set. So, yes, it's possible that the commission may impose higher rate on the streamers, depending on how it interprets its mandate and the evidence submitted in phase three, but that is that's a few months away before we'll revisit those issues. And lastly, I think real change would still require asking whether our system of subsidies and certifications and regulations is it delivering cultural value? And we're not there yet. No one is asking that question. And so everyone's still arguing over how to divide the pie, and nobody's really asking if it's still worth eating.
Well, it's a great way to close. I'm glad you're asking that question. And perhaps as more people become aware of what is taking place in Gatineau, kind of out of the spotlight, there will be more concern and interest in, what is this all about and what is it ultimately achieving? Mark, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast and walking through the last few weeks at the CRTC in a really accessible way. There are many, many hours. It's great to be able to distill it down in the way that you just did.
Thank you, Michael. It's been fun.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. That's LAWBYTES. At PO Box.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter at LawBitesPod or follow Michael Geist at MGeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe at iTunes, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening and see you next time.